Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 3.
The French word for superfluous is de trop. In Roquentin's experience, the existences in the park, the trees, the gates, the stones, were de trop. Roquentin felt himself to be de trop. Extra, without enough reason to be there, without excuse, just there, superfluous. And if any of these existences happened not to be there, if any of them were to die, it would make absolutely no difference. If Roquentin were to kill himself, it would make no difference. All the rest of this stuff would still be there, unaffected. It would have made no difference. Roquentin describes this horror.
This moment was extraordinary. I was there, motionless, paralyzed, plunged into horrible ecstasy. But at the heart of this ecstasy, something new had just appeared. I understood the nausea. I possessed it. To tell the truth, I did not formulate my discoveries to myself. But I think it would be easy for me to put them in words now. The essential point is contingency. I mean that, by definition, existence is not necessity. To exist is simply to be there. Existences appear, let themselves be encountered, but you can never deduce them. Everything is gratuitous. This park, this city, and myself. When you realize this, your heart turns over and everything begins to float.
For Sartre, as for Antoine Roquentin, when you realize the contingency of existence, you're on your way to realizing your true situation in the world. You realize that existences are not only beyond your words, they're beyond your laws and reasons. There's nothing in them to rely on. In the next minute, they might turn into anything. They might do anything. You and they are contingencies only. Realizing this, you are on your way to taking responsibility for your life. What you realize most fundamentally, Sartre thinks, is a central philosophical truth, that human reality is paradoxical. On the one hand, life is nothing much, nothing more than some more of this stuff of things. Human beings are bodies among other bodies, thrown into existence without intrinsic meaning. But on the other hand, human reality is of momentous importance, since human beings are the source of all the meaning there is. We saw earlier with Roquentin that life's events have no meaning of their own. We give meaning to them by the stories we tell. With Roquentin just now, we saw that natural things also are indifferent to us. We give meaning to them by how we see them, talk about them, and interpret them. Indeed, we're caught up in the pure brute existence of the physical and biological world. But we're more. We transcend that mere existence because we're aware of it. In this awareness is our freedom. Human beings are dual. We're mere stuff and transcendence of stuff. Now, this is rather like a very old view of human existence, one which goes back to Plato, at least. The old views found in another form in Aristotle and in the medieval religious philosophers such as Thomas Aquinas. In yet another version, the dual view of human existence prevailed in the philosophical tradition of Sartre's French predecessor, the 17th century thinker René Descartes. Descartes thought that in order to account for the duality in human existence, we have to consider humans to be two distinct things, a body and a soul or mind. The body's caught up in the physical world, and the mind is not. This view's come to be called dualism, since it holds that each human being is a combination of two interacting realities of very different kinds. This dualistic way of thinking is very powerful. So powerful, in fact, that it's sunk deeply into our common understanding of things. It's a part of religious thought, We even find popular songs called Body and Soul. But Sartre strongly rejects the view. To understand what's distinctive in Sartre's existential version of duality, we have to understand why he rejected Descartes' dualism of mind and body. One reason, of course, is that Descartes' dualism poses more questions than it answers. For example, no one's ever made clear how such very different realities, an immaterial mind or soul on the one hand, and a physical body on the other, could possibly interact. But for Sartre, the central failure of dualism is experiential. We don't experience ourselves as two things, a soul and a body. Above all, we don't experience ourselves, as Descartes thought we did, as souls encased inside our bodies. We don't experience our conscious selves as somehow cut off from our bodies in the outside world, just sending out signals and getting them back. We're not caught up in ourselves as in some kind of container. We're not always struggling to get out of ourselves, to get beyond the way things appear to us, to reach some mysterious hidden world behind appearance. We experience ourselves all along as being embodied, and thus as being out in the world. We experience the world directly as the field of being and activity where we're already at work. We are inseparable from the world, and the world is inseparable from us. To signal this inevitable and mutual involvement of self and world, Sartre borrows an expression from the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. He calls human existence being in the world. The emphasis here is on being in. Human existence is in the world, not like water's in a bucket, but as a person is in trouble or in a situation. From this point of view, Sartre says,
consciousness is an abstraction. Since it conceals within itself its source in the region of material existence, the concrete can only be the synthetic totality of which consciousness constitutes but a moment. The concrete is man within the world in that specific union of man with the world which Heidegger calls being in the world.
Sartre's massive philosophical book, Being and Nothingness, presents his attempt to describe human existence as being in the world. Let's follow his argument as it develops in this book. To begin, we need to ask what becomes of the duality in human existence. The answer is that it's found within the concreteness of our being in the world. For Descartes, there were two kinds of things, minds and bodies. For Sartre, on the other hand, there are two dimensions of being. The first dimension is called being in itself. This is what things are just in themselves. The second dimension he calls being for itself. This is how things are for conscious life. These two dimensions of being, being in itself and being for itself, can be experienced within the integrated reality of human being in the world. Sartre wants us to understand being in itself to mean all of existence taken just as it is, in itself, as mere being. This is what we found Roquentin experiencing in the park as mere existence. Being in itself simply is. It has no intrinsic meaning. Everything is in itself, including human beings. We're thrown among bare existences, the stuff of things. But we're more. In human beings, the world takes on meaning. It becomes being for itself. The world lights up with awareness and becomes for us. Yet Sartre thinks this new dimension called the for itself doesn't arise because we have a special kind of thing in us, a soul or a mind. It arises because through us a certain kind of nothingness appears. So he says,
human being is the being by which nothingness arrives in the world.
By using this strange notion of nothingness, Sartre wants to underline a peculiar characteristic of human reality. Because of this characteristic, human reality is in the world, giving it meaning. This characteristic of nothingness is not a peculiar thing that we bring with us. Quite the opposite. If you take us apart, all you actually get is physical stuff, more stuff. What's distinctive about us is our conscious life, and consciousness is not a thing of some sort. If we think in terms of things, we have to say that human consciousness is a nothing, not a thing, no thing. Instead, human reality is a special way of existing, a way of being out among things, of intending things, of being at them, as Sartre sometimes puts it. Since we're at things, they take on meaning for us. This conscious way of existing is the way we humans most concretely experience ourselves. Sartre adds that this conscious way of existing is a kind of active nothing, a negating. We have a distinctive experience of ourselves in time, for instance. When we act, we put our past behind us and act towards our future. Quite precisely, we experience ourselves as not being what we were in the past and as not yet being what we will be in the future. Sartre puts this in his curious way.
We are not what we are, and we are what we are not.
To Sartre, we are not what we presently are. Instead, we are the past and the future that we are not. Basically, we live toward our future possibilities. These possibilities are not yet actual. But in the way we project this not yet of the future, we determine what we now are. So, as we experience ourselves in time, we are not what we are, and we are what we are not. But what on earth is the upshot of all this, you might ask? In short, so what? Sartre believes that these basic ideas help us interpret certain experiences which reveal the human condition to us. Interpreting these fundamental experiences in as faithful a way as possible is what his book Being and Nothingness is all about. Consider the experience of anguish. At its bottom, Sartre thinks that to experience anxiety is to experience our radical freedom. By experiencing the nothingness in us in each moment, we put our past behind us and feel the uncertainty of our future. In order to see this, we first must distinguish between fear and anguish.
Anguish is distinguished from fear in that fear is fear of beings in the world, whereas anguish is anguish before myself. A situation provokes fear if there is a possibility of my life being changed from without. My being provokes anguish to the extent that I distrust myself and my own reactions in that situation. The artillery preparation which precedes the attack can provoke fear in the soldier who undergoes the bombardment, but his anguish begins when he tries to foresee the conduct with which he will face the bombardment, when he asks himself if he is going to be able to hold out.
Sartre asks us to imagine that we're climbing on a narrow mountain path which goes along a precipice without a guardrail. We may feel vertigo. The vertigo announces itself through fear. It's dangerous. I might fall. I need to watch my step, and so on. But the vertigo itself is not fear. For what I fear comes from without. If I were confident that I could handle the fear and could take proper precautions, there would be no vertigo. But if I experience vertigo, if I find myself in horror of the precipice, I realize that it's myself that concerns me, not the external dangers. If I experience vertigo, it's because I realize that what I will do in the future is only possible. I'm not now what I will be then. I cannot now be certain what I will then do. All of this is because I am not a determinism. I am a freedom.
I am in anguish precisely because any action on my part is only possible. And this means that while constituting a set of motives for avoiding a fall, I, at the same moment, apprehend these motives as not sufficiently effective. At the very moment when I apprehend my being as horror of the precipice, I am conscious of that horror as non-determining in relation to my possible conduct. A nothingness has slipped between my future being and my present being. I am not the self which I will be, and if nothing compels me to save my life, nothing prevents me from throwing myself into the abyss. The decisive conduct will emanate from a self which I am not yet.
Sartre is suggesting that the experience of vertigo is an experience of anguish in the face of the future. Anguish in the face of the future is one way in which we experience our dreadful freedom. There's another way, too. We can experience anguish in the face of the past. Take the case of a gambler. Suppose he's freely and sincerely decided not to gamble anymore. But when he approaches the gaming table, he sees all his resolutions melt away. He still remembers them. He wants to identify with them. He believes in the effectiveness of his resolution.
But what he apprehends, then, in anguish, is precisely the total inefficacy of the past resolution. It is there, doubtless, but congealed, ineffectual, transcended by the very fact that the I is conscious of it. I find that I am not subjected to it. It fails in the mission which I have given it. The resolution is still there. I am it in the mode of not being. What the gambler apprehends at this instant is again the permanent rupture with determinism. It is nothingness which separates him from himself.
The gambler's reflection might continue.
I should have liked so much not to gamble anymore. Yesterday, it seemed to me that I had established a real barrier between gambling and myself. And now I suddenly perceive that my former understanding of the situation is no more than a memory of an idea, a memory of a feeling. In order for it to come to my aid once more, I must remake it ex nihilo and freely. The not gambling is only one of my possibilities, as the fact of gambling is another of them. Neither more nor less. I must rediscover the fear of financial ruin or of disappointing my family, etc. I must recreate it as experienced fear. It stands behind me like a boneless phantom. It depends on me alone to lend it my flesh. I am alone and naked before temptation as I was the day before. I perceive with anguish that nothing prevents me from gambling. The anguish is me.
Now, Sartre is quick to say that an experience like this anguish in the face of the past, or anguish in the face of the future, doesn't prove human freedom. It's always possible to say that there are other effective causes for what we do, but that we don't know what they are. Sartre's point is that our experience of ourselves clearly refutes this idea. We don't experience ourselves as causally determined to do what we do. We experience ourselves as agonizingly free. It's not that we find it more appealing and comforting to believe in our freedom. On the contrary, our freedom is frightening. Sartre says we don't experience the freedom of a full self in control of life, assuring itself of identity and power. Rather, we experience the freedom of an empty self, always having to choose and re-choose ourselves, with no assurance that we have an identity or power. It's a freedom of possibility only, of openness, of indeterminism. We constantly seek to escape this freedom precisely by trying to set up determinisms to ease our minds.
This is the end of part 3. Please download part 4 to continue.